The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Hello, this is Martha Potter from the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next half hour, I'll be reading to you from Our State Magazine. Today's reading of Our State Magazine is underwritten by Carter Glass Insurance Agency, serving the community since 1974 and underwriting this podcast for over 15 years. They can be reached at 919-781-1973. The May issue of Our State Magazine focuses on moms, so we'll continue through the section entitled Legacy of Love, a Mother's Day Tribute, starting with the article entitled The Matriarchs of Ocean Isle. There was a time when the shores of Ocean Isle Beach were empty, save for one family. In the decades since, generations of Sloan women have helped to turn this place into a vacationer's paradise. Dawn didn't break over Ocean Isle Beach on October 15, 1954, but waves did. They towered over the shore in the weak morning light, thundering onto the sand as if to herald the arrival of Hurricane Hazel. She blew into town on winds 140 miles an hour strong, riding a storm surge 18 feet high. To make matters worse, it was a full moon with the highest lunar tide of the year. The official report from the Weather Bureau in Raleigh said all traces of civilization on the immediate waterfront between the South Carolina state line and Cape Fear were practically annihilated. Those wind-driven waves, that nearly two-story storm surge, and the high tide conspired to erase communities along the coast. The water and wind shooed channels through the dunes, toppled centuries-old trees, and drove even the most seasoned watermen and coastal dwellers inside or inland for shelter and safety. On Ocean Isle Beach, Hazel left little behind but bare ground and a strip of land almost completely devoid of life. Nevertheless, the barrier island beckoned to one intrepid couple. In June of 1955, George Sloan II and his wife Ray decided to swap city life in Columbia, South Carolina, for a place that they'd helped mold for generations. My father was offered a job selling real estate on Ocean Isle, Debbie Sloan Smith recalls years later. He decided he wanted to live at the beach, so he moved us down here, him, my mother, and two toddlers, to an island with no bridge, no telephones, and not much more than a car ferry. The Sloans gathered their two children, Tripp and Debbie, and headed for the coast, becoming the first, and for 15 years only, permanent year-round residents of Ocean Isle Beach. The barrier island had always been sparsely populated, but in the 1940s, Ray's uncle, developer Odell Williamson, saw its potential as a vacation destination. Prior to Hazel, he'd begun buying tracts of land. Afterward, he hired George to sell the lots. George and Ray saw their own opportunity and founded Sloan Realty a few years after arriving. In 1959, they opened the Ocean Isle Motel, occupying one wing of the seven-room property and renting the rest. Tripp and Debbie grew up in the real estate and hospitality business, helping their mother around the hotel when Ray was pregnant with their new baby sister. My mother got so big she couldn't fit in those little motel bathrooms, so she put me and Tripp to work cleaning, Debbie says. In those days, there was no one around but the Sloans and some fishermen. The kids had the run of the island, and they spent their days searching the sand for treasures, climbing the dunes, swimming in the ocean, and fishing. Sometimes fishing was more than just fun. Oh, Mama would send us out to go crabbing or to dig clams, Debbie said. If the mullet were running, she'd have us get a few for supper, and we'd save the roe to have for breakfast. It was like Little House on the Prairie, island style. Looking back, we had nothing, Debbie says. It was fine when we were little, but when you got older, it wasn't really as fun as memory makes it seem. As the foraging beach wild Sloan kids started to realize the work of things, their world was changing. Sloan Realty was managing a roster of vacation properties that steadily grew as more houses were built. George and his brother-in-law opened an arcade with pool tables and pinball. And at ages 13 and 14, Debbie and Tripp ran it. With age came more responsibility. Debbie was called into the real estate business, earning her license at age 17. When I was in high school, my father died suddenly, she says. But by that time, I'd been sitting at his typewriting, helping out for years. His eyesight was bad, and he had me typing contracts. They were all fill-in-the-blank forms, so he'd sit beside me and dictate. After George died, Ray was left with the business. Debbie sits up a little straighter at the memory, matriarchal pride putting steel in her spine. Until then, it had always been them, with us kids providing some worthless help, of course. But Mom still insisted I go to college. Debbie left for a year, but returned home most weekends to help her mother. She got married, built a house in Wilmington, and made the daily drive down U.S. Highway 17 to work. We didn't live in Wilmington 6 months before my mother enticed us away from the city with a piece of waterway property we could afford. So we moved down. Temporarily, she chuckles. Temporarily has turned into a long time. Like her mother, Debbie, Whitney Sauls grew up in the real estate and hospitality business, where Debbie cleaned motel rooms and ran an arcade. Whitney spent her formative years handing check-in packets to vacationers. Today, she's general manager of Sloan Realty Vacations. My brother and I, we were born and raised on the island, of course, and we were in the business early, Whitney says. If we weren't giving out check-in packets at the front desk, we were in an office stuffing them. Mom would say, we have 300 checking in this week, and my brother and I would just roll our eyes and get to work. The parallels between mother and daughter run deeper. By the time I started first grade, I'd covered every inch of this island on bicycle or on foot, Debbie says. We had undeveloped land on the West End, so we'd play there. And as teenagers, we'd go four-wheeling down there or have little parties between the dunes. Oh, my brother and friends and I would go out in the dunes, too, Whitney says. We'd take Mom's Jeep for a joyride, and 6 months later, she didn't understand why it's completely corroded or suddenly pulls to the left. We thought we were being sneaky. Teen shenanigans aside, Whitney and her brother Charles Fox, now a custom home builder, turned out fine. And they know they owe a lot to their mother. Probably the best lesson she taught me was how to work, Whitney says. I learned this business like she did, from her mother and from the ground up. Which is why Whitney's twin daughters, Sloan and Sydney, have grown up at their mother's feet, always involved in some aspect of the family's hospitality holdings. They'll graduate high school this year, and college is in their sights, but both have an interest in the business. Sloan's the one who said it out loud. I want to be a part of this. This is a fourth generation of women building, leading, and guiding Ocean Isle Beach. Debbie Sloan Smith is more than a lifer on Ocean Isle, and more than a second generation of women to lead the Sloan Realty Empire. She's also been the mayor for 22 years. When my father passed, my parents had finally started to get their heads above water. I saw all these men come around and trying to buy the businesses from Mom, treating her like some little woman who didn't know better. But I saw her stand strong, Debbie says. I saw her turn down a six-figure offer because she said that money would only do us for a few years, but she knew she could build a real life if she stuck to the business and grew it. And she did. By the time Ray died in 2022 at age 92, the motel had been replaced with the 70-room Ocean Isle Inn. Today, Sloan Realty manages some 400 vacation and long-term rental properties in Ocean Isle Beach and Sunset Beach. Some are owned by second or third generation of families that originally bought from Ray and George. What Ray Sloan Cox established, Debbie Sloan Smith expanded, and Whitney Sauls continues to grow. And the memories that their family has made on the island, all those sunny days and starry nights have multiplied as they welcome other families to Ocean Isle Beach, often reserving the same house for the same family over the same week, summer after summer. There's a nostalgic charm along the whole of the Carolina coast that you don't experience often today, Debbie says. Once people experience life here, it sets a hook in them. They want to come back, even if it's only for a week. Our next article is entitled, A Gallery for Good. In Durham, the Ella West Gallery embodies the values that its namesake imparted to her daughter: community, love, and an appreciation for the beauty in all things. Every day at the Ella West Gallery in downtown Durham, Linda Shropshire sits by a large photograph of her mother, the Ella West, when Shropshire doteth. Gazing over the desk in Linda's office, a young Ella flashes a megawatt smile with the free spirit of a woman in her early 20s. In the portrait, made in the 1960s, Ella sports a new short haircut and a blowout. She tilts her head as if catching a breeze in the punchline of an inside joke. Linda says the photo was taken impromptu by James Peeler, a notable black photographer who documented his community in Charlotte. Ella was queued up in line with dozens of other young black women for a pageant when Peeler snapped her portrait. This image of Ella, a dedication to the gallery's namesake, embodies a sense of stewardship, one Linda describes as an innate appreciation for beauty in all its forms. It's a trait, she says, she inherited from her mother, along with a great eye for finding art, the ability to beautify a space no matter the resources, and the mission to live and build each day from a place of love. My mother's happy, always laughing. She's a charmer, Linda says, and she sees all these beautiful parts in people. In much the same way, this is how Linda describes her quest to tell stories through the artwork hanging in the gallery walls. For each piece, the medium may vary. Surrealist portraiture photography, mixed media jumping off the canvas in three-dimensional texture, abstract brushstrokes in neutral tones, pop art in bright colors. Together, the art provides a living history of black, brown, and women artists, many of them young, and their experiences at home in the South and beyond. And I get to share the narratives, Linda says, because it's not enough for someone to come in and just look at it. I get to share the narratives and what it means, and I get to do it sitting as a black woman. I'm at the intersection of the fabric of a culture that I can explain from a lived experience. Sometimes when she talks about her mother, Linda blinks back tears. But it's not because she's sad. Her tears convey awe, appreciation, and love. They frame the way her eyes widen and marvel at all her mother has done and continues to do. Sitting by a window at home in North Durham, Ella gazes out at the sky. A Bible lies open in her lap, where she rests one hand over the other. She counts the cars that drive past and smooths back her white-gray hair pulled tight into a low ponytail. Linda offers her tea and promises that dinner will be ready soon. Ella checks her watch, reminding Linda every few minutes that it's almost 5 and that she wants warm rolls with her meal. These days, she forgets that her daughter runs a gallery named after her. For the past couple of years, she has lived with dementia. She spends her days at home with her daughter often by her side. Linda is essentially both a full-time caretaker and a full-time gallery owner. Mentally, she's great, Linda says of her mother. She's in mental decline, but she's not depressed. She wakes up happy, laughing. I think she's doing as well as she can because she's got constant love and care and stimulation. Ella was born on a farm in Monroe in 1941. One of the youngest of 8 children, she was a preemie and consequently treated like everybody's baby sister, with extra sweetness and care. She later named Linda after her own younger sister. Linda says her mother lived and created a simple, generous life. Ella always kept her home meticulously clean. She canned tomatoes. Her nieces would call her up to design their homes, and she always found deals on decor, art, and furniture that reflected and elevated their living spaces. For most of Linda's childhood, Ella owned and operated a hair salon. She often wore red lipstick and later in the 1980s and 90s, a baby pink hue. It complemented the big hair she sported, which billowed like feathers and drew comparisons to the superstar Tina Turner. After her 2 children were grown and long gone from the home, Ella began fostering a young teen mother, Shanna Jones. Ella eventually supported her through nursing school. Jones, now a grandmother in Virginia, visits Ella often and helps out with care if Linda needs it. At the gallery, Linda speaks with people all day. She listens, she interprets, she absorbs. She does the same thing at home with her mother. Ella spins tales that aren't often linear, but they are big exclamations of truth in her lived experiences. Linda patiently listens. With dementia, memory can be elusive, or it can be very specific. Time and space collapse. The present moment is what you get. This is where both Linda and Ella live. They experience the present differently, but they experience it together. The irony of dementia, despite the neurological effects that can harp on the act of remembering the past, is that it forces people to live exactly what's in front of them. For Linda, a mantra she picked up from a book by Deborah Barr grounds her. Cherish what remains. Today, that's Ella and her graceful show of love. God's taking care of you, she says. Heaven is everywhere. At the core of Ella West's world, both the gallery and the person, there's an almost cyclical nature of coincidence, of a meant-to-be type fate. The gallery inhabits an alcove at 104 West Parrish Street, part of Durham's historic Black Wall Street. Around the 1920s, that same block housed the printing press for the Durham Reformer, one of the city's first black newspapers, as well as the company news publication for NC Mutual, once known as the oldest and largest African-American life insurance company in the United States, established in 1898. Today, you enter the front door to find rare lithographs by Durham's own Ernie Barnes. One of his quotes takes over the left wall. An artist paints his own reality. Linda first heard of Barnes through her junior high school art teacher, Mr. Winston Fletcher, who was a friend and a contemporary of Barnes. His work was her entree into the world of art. She was in her 20s when she purchased her first piece, a portrait of a faceless woman carrying a child on her back. The painting, Mother and Child by Floyd Gordon, struck Linda, who was married but not yet a mother when she saw it. It took her 9 months to pay it off. Now the piece hangs as the focal point of her bedroom. Her daughters, Taylor and Sydney Grissom, recall that this same painting as a core memory of their own childhood. Linda worked in the corporate grind for several years. In 2020, she went back to school for an MBA at UNC Chapel Hill's Kenan Flagler Business School. And there, an idea for a gallery kept bouncing around in her brain. She wrote a business plan and pushed for her dream to take back Black Wall Street with art. This gallery, gracing a prominent corner of downtown Durham, is an evolution of the city's black history, offering a space for reflection and community. Artists, Linda says, operate from a heart place that we can't often tap into. In the same vein, she speaks of Ella's life, led with an open heart that finds the beauty in everyone. Decades after she first saw it, Linda views the maternal portrait as a representation of the strength and the nature of my legacy, with a mom who basically could carry anything on her back. She carried many people on her back. Motherhood, she says, is a humbling experience that teaches you a new level of love. The Ella West Gallery is located at 104 West Parrish Street in Durham, and they have a website, ellawestgallery.com. The next article is entitled A Vine Through Time. For more than 400 years, the mother vine has grown on Roanoke Island. Her story is that of one legendary plant, its many careful caretakers, and the will to keep her public. And there is a picture here of the vine itself, and it's said to be the oldest cultivated grapevine in North America. The mother vine twists, tangles, and grows on in Manteo. And it is used, and they have built an arbor to support it, a wooden arbor under its different limbs and such. Outside a mid-century modern ranch house on the northeast side of Roanoke Island, a dense network of vines commands the front yard, its filigree of young leaves bouncing in the breeze. In some spots, delicate buds have developed into firm green grapes, nowhere near the juicy scuppernongs they'll ripen as the summer progresses. These vines, all offshoots attached to the same Herculean system, blanket the entire south side of the yard as though unfurled from a bolt of scraggly, stemmy fabric. The canopy hangs about 5 feet off the ground, supported by a massive arbor made of black locust wood, which used to grow plentifully on the coast. Toward the edge of the lot, a wooden sign faces Mother Vineyard Road, its big yellow letters reading, "Welcome, Mother Vine." Duck your head, step underneath the arbor, and discover sizable vines funneling in tightly woven tangles. Venture deeper in, and the view of the nearby house and road become obscured by a veil of brown and green. For all we don't know about the Mother Vine, her exact age, or who originally cultivated her, there is one thing we do know. That the vine that English colonists encountered 400 years ago is not the same Mother Vine you see today. Her shape changes over the decades. Old roots die, and new ones take their place. "She's done all this on her own," John Wilson says, gesturing to the sprawling vine that he calls Old Girl. Wilson does know the Old Girl well. His dad built his childhood home next to the Mother Vine in 1957. He grew up playing under the arbor and picking grapes that he sold to passing tourists. "Oh, what a lot of tourists," he admits, "maybe 5 or 6 a day, and sometimes none. I'd be out there with my bicycle and my card table trying to sell grapes. My mother was probably on the phone with the neighbor saying, 'Please come buy some grapes from John,' he says, laughing." Wilson insists that the Mother Vine's story is not about him. "My time is this big," he says, holding his hands a bread loaf's length apart. "My father had 60-some years with this vine. Wilson inherited the Old Girl from his parents, Jack and Estelle, when they passed in 2018. He's in the process of transferring its ownership to Outer Banks Conservationists, OBC, the nonprofit that preserves and manages the Currituck Beach Lighthouse in Kerala and Island Farm, a 19th-century living history farm on Roanoke Island. It was Jack and Estelle's wish that the Mother Vine remain available to the public for future generations. There's also a personal connection. Wilson and his partner Bill Parker founded OBC in 1980, and Wilson is currently the board chair. The properties they've saved over the years all have ties to the Wilson family. Estelle's grandfather was a lightkeeper for the Currituck Beach Lighthouse, so she spent summers at the compound in historic Kerala Village. Jack was a descendant of the Etheridges, the longtime Roanoke Island family that established Island Farm. At one time, the Mother Vine and its surrounding, Mother Vineyard were part of the farm. Now the vine is the final piece that will complete the Trinity. Mother Vine was part of the Etheridge's family property, Wilson says. He and the organization are trying to get more of the land back to our little farm. For much of the 20th century, Mother Vineyard Road was mostly unpaved with just a few houses. Other grapevines, believed to be descendants of the Mother Vine, made up the Mother Vineyard and stretched for acres, creating a divide between the road and the sandy beach where children would bike to play in the shallow sound waters, their dogs trailing close behind. Mom loved seeing the kids come up on their bikes. She'd invite them in, Wilson recalls. As the Mother Vine became more and more developed, it's upset her to see neighbors put up no trespassing signs, stopping access to the water. She always wanted it to be so welcoming. At Estelle's urging, John and Jack bought a parcel of the Mother Vineyard near the beach and transferred it to OBC in 2018. It's in Mom's will that she wanted it to be for dogs and children and bicycles in perpetuity, Wilson says. "We don't have any public lands at Mother Vineyard attached to Roanoke Island, and my mom wanted at least one little piece of land that was." Estelle and Jack took their roles as the Mother Vine's stewards seriously. In addition to maintaining the property for decades, they revived the Old Girl from a deadly poisoning in 2010 that caught the attention from everyone from NC State and NPR to the Los Angeles Times. In the last 15 years of their lives, they discussed its future extensively. "It was just Mom and Dad and Billy and me talking about the future of Mother Vine and what can be done," Wilson remembers. They didn't want it to be cut down. They didn't want the land to be overly developed. When determining who could assume care of the vine and protect the surrounding land for future generations, the choice was simple. Our joint decision that it should be transferred to the Outer Banks conservationist to be made available to the public to view and take pictures of it forever, Wilson says. For OBC, the partnership was mutual. It's a natural responsibility for OBC to assume, based on the conservation work we're already doing, because the mother vine does need to be looked after and cared for, Executive Director Ladd Bayless says. The full transfer will include the Wilson family's house, so a dedicated staff member can live on site and look after the vine. By protecting the mother vine, the Wilson's legacy is preserving a piece of old Roanoke Island. As a boy, Jack learned from his grandfather that the gnarled vine that had once belonged to their farm was the oldest cultivated grapevine in North America. As a girl, Estelle would walk from downtown Manio past the Mother Vineyard to Fort Raleigh, where she played a flower girl in the inaugural production of The Lost Colony. This was a time when Randy Griffith's house was one of the only ones on Roanoke Sound between the Mother Vine and Fort Raleigh. Look at the north end of Roanoke Island today, and you wouldn't recognize it. A bulwark along the Sound protects miles of homes and jetties and docks. Thanks to Estelle's wishes, however, there will always be a lot that welcomes passersby to marvel at the massive vine and stoop under its arbor. There will always be a place that invites visitors to stroll behind the house with a child or a dog or a bicycle in tow. When they do, they'll take in the view where the yard meets the Roanoke Sound, a view that has cultivated interest for 400 years. And there's a picture here of Ladd Bayless. She's the executive director of Outer Banks Conservationists, and she's attending to the vine. And there are several pictures of showing Estelle and Jack and Estelle and Jack Vineyard, and they have a little archway over a gate that says Mother Vineyard. And back a page, there's some pictures of the sunlight coming through the arbor. This is a younger part of the grapevine. And a picture of John Wilson of the Outer Banks, who co-founded the Outer Banks Conservationists. This is an amazing, massive vine. It's incredible. Well, that sound means that we've run out of time for today's episode of Our State Magazine. I hope you've enjoyed it and that you'll be sure to listen next time. I'm Martha Potter, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. Today's reading of Our State Magazine is underwritten by Carter Glass Insurance Agency, serving the community since 1974. They can be reached at 919-781-1973. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired and is readily available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any questions or comments, please give us a call at 919-832-5138. So long until next time.